Welcome to the Weekly Squeak, your weekly geeky squeak with me, Christian Giller. I have a slight cold, as you might be able to hear, so do excuse my overtones there. And in this show, I am going to give you part two of my interviews from the recent KubeCon, the conference in Barcelona, all about Kubernetes and new models in cloud computing, hybrid cloud computing, etc., 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 etc. And then next week, we'll be back to a Lynx show, back to the usual schedule. So on this show, first is an interview with the CEO of Solo.io, Idit Levine. Now, this interview was an interesting one. I've left it fairly unedited, despite there being several points where she shows me things, and the way we were talking was sometimes kind of odd for an interview, but she has such enthusiasm for what she's talking about and such love of her product. I kind of wanted to leave it as raw as possible so you could hear that, and hopefully you do. And hopefully it's not too hard for you to understand what's going on at times when she's showing me demos and things, but her enthusiasm and passion comes through. My second interview is with Shiv Ramji from DigitalOcean, where we talk about DigitalOcean's pushes into the Kubernetes space and what they're going to be offering in the very near future. And finally, on the next day, back in a different location, just before I left the lovely Barcelona, I had an interview with Matt Whittington of Atlassian. Now, Atlassian don't offer any Kubernetes services, but we talk about how they are using Kubernetes for their own products. So, enjoy.
So my name is Idit Levine, and I'm the founder and the CEO of Solo.io. It's a company based in Boston area, and we basically help enterprise to adopt open source product by actually writing tools, not like services. So it's really cool.
Okay, so what does that, let's go into a bit more detail about what that means.
So I'll expand. So basically when I started the company, so I worked in a lot of startup company before. I worked in Dynamicop, who got acquired by VMware. We did cloud before cloud was cloud. I worked in CloudSwitch, who got acquired by Verizon. And I worked in EMC, that was the CTO of Cloud Management Division. So we did really kind of like open source project and innovative. And what I noticed is that the enterprise has a big problem and actually adopt it. So like if I'm putting any open source project out there, there's me and a few people kind of like surrounding it. But in the end of the day, the enterprise has a huge gap to actually adopt that technology. So when we started the company, that was kind of like the mission. We're going to bring them with us. We want to do innovation, but we first need to close this gap before we actually innovate. So basically, that's exactly what we did. Like we have line of product. So we have basically, you know, what we notice is that every enterprise has today a problem to, you know, they all want to do a digital transformation, right? But what does it mean, right? So the first thing that I noticed that is the biggest problem is that they're trying to move from monolithic application to microservices. Okay, that's great. Then the other thing is that once they actually move to microservices, they have a new set of problems, right? So a problem like, for instance, how do you, now it's all distributed. So how do you make one microservice talk to the other? How do you manage to make sure that they will do it securely? How do you make sure that you can see what's going on in this cluster right now, which is all distributed, the state is everywhere? And all of those problems, these three problems, is being solved today by service mesh. So that's the second thing that they should adopt. Now, the technology of service mesh actually, you know, dealing with these three use cases, but actually the implementation itself is decoupling the logic of the business logic of the application from the operation. Before that, you needed to bake it inside your microservice. Now it's basically detach it and bring it to the sidecar. If that technology actually means that you abstract your network, so there's way more we can help you with. Like, for instance, I know we show you some product, I can show you some stuff that we're working on, but for instance, we will be able to do more stuff that related to the health of the application, for instance, debugging, troubleshooting, and a lot of other stuff that we can do on this because we abstract the network. So that's exactly what we did at the company. The first product that we put out there called Glue, G-L-O-O, Glue.
Oh, okay, yep.
Like gluing those environment of the monolithic microservice and serverless. So it's an API gateway based on Envoy, but it's by, and it's open source, but it's by far, in my opinion, the best. And the reason is because of its architecture and the fact that it's kind of like taking the first citizen about this gluing piece, which I think is very important because if you're going today to enterprise, they usually have more than one type of architecture. So that's the first one. The second one that we did, I didn't feel that it makes sense for me to do another service mesh. There is so many. So instead of that, what I did, I realized that they're going to be the problem next. And what is the next problem that they're going to be? The next problem is going to be that you're going to have an organization that will be more than one instance of meshes. So it could be that you will have two instances of Estio, but it's two instances, right? Or maybe one instance of Estio and one in AppMesh because you're running on AWS and, you know, it's free and integrated with everything there. You probably want to use it. So what we did, we basically came in an orchestration. We're calling it Superglue. Mm-hmm. And what Superglue is doing is first, you get the, yeah, exactly. And basically what it's doing, it's, first of all, it's helping you very simply install. So it's like one line, Superglue install Estio namespace edit, boom, it's working. Same thing with the console, right? And AppMesh and everything. Then once you, now if you already install, we're discovering it. So we know exactly what is the service mesh that you're using, what is the configuration that you gave him, and what services is running and serving this. So it's kind of like giving you a lot of visibility. And then once we're doing this, everything is basically very, it's a toggle, it's very simple. Instead of creating four different objects in Estio in order to create, to define the retry, we just took it upside down. So now you're just saying, you know, we have a list of all the service mesh that we're actually managing. Then we can just say Superglue, Estio 1, Service 1, retry. Now we're going to go and create all of this for you. So that's one, number one. So what it's allowing you, because we've come with an API that is very simple, for all the services mesh, you can sweep, right? You can, you don't have to be locked to a provider. Who knows who will win? We don't know. So now it's basically giving you the ability to start, for instance, with LinkedIn and then swap it to Estio when it's more mature. So that's giving you, this is a big use case that we're hearing from our customer. And the last thing that we did, we're basically giving you the ability to kind of like group them together and we're flattening the networking. So basically we're creating one big mesh from instances of meshes. So we can say this AppMesh instance and this on-prem Estio, all of them are production and I want them to use these primitives. Mm-hmm. So that's basically what we did and that's what Superglue. But as I said, and this is actually a real tight to a big announcement that's going to be today in the conference, so I will discuss that a little bit. Last week, we also announced something called Service Mesh Hub. Mm-hmm. And this is basically the vision of Superglue. It's a platform in the end of the day, which is basically the ability to, you know, install a mesh, right, which in one click. And then the ability to extend it, because the beauty of kind of like coming with this API is that now everybody can build this and it will work on every mesh. So we're basically creating this ability in the Service Mesh Hub is basically, you know, you can install and then the community can put a lot of extension. We put some for ourselves, for debugging and for the others. And again, I can talk a little bit more about that. And then basically you can just, like an iPhone, click and extend and now it's working. And it's smart because you understand the mesh, so it can actually make sure that it's configured well. You don't need to do anything because we know which primitives you're using. So when you're installing something like Flagger, it's just going to work, you know? So that's that. Now, we actually very lucky, but we managed to convince Microsoft that that's a good vision. So today, the big announcement on the keynote of Microsoft is basically that. So basically what we took, Superglue is doing a lot of stuff, but one of the things that it's doing is also the translation to the mesh. So basically Microsoft with us and Voyant and Ashikop took this API and basically took it out from Superglue. And now basically what we're doing is we managed to make the provider themselves do this translation, which is better for us, right? Because I want to build on top of the mesh. So now basically what will happen, actually could build this adapter for the, we call it SMI, Service Mesh Interface, so this API. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we wanted to give to the CNCF eventually, and we want the community to help us build it. And that should be owned by us. Mm-hmm. So I'm totally, you know, I was totally pushing it. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, the beautiful of it is that the launch partner is us, actually Buoyant and Microsoft. But besides that, we already convinced quite a lot of companies like VMware, Rancher, Docker, F5, Reddit. So all of them are very basically buying into this, which is couldn't be better for us. It's a startup company who came with this a year ago, right? It can be better. So, and the beautiful of it is that we are the only one who have actually the implementation. It's open source. So it's, you know, really, it's really exciting. So we're going to launch today. That launch, you will see a huge shout out for us. And what we want to do is, okay, so we're using SMI and we're basically having this really easy kind of like experience that we only have to actually manage multi-meshes, which I believe will happen. And again, it could be two instances of Istio. It's pretty simple, right? But you still need to manage them both. And then what we're doing next is we're leveraging the, we have a lot of product that basically leveraging the fact that you're running on top of the mesh. So we have something that we're coming right now. We're actually building it with Lyft. Mm-hmm. What it is basically...
Lyft the...
The company. Yeah. Okay. And basically what we're doing... So Lyft is the one who came with Envoy, right? Mm-hmm. So they're running Envoy internally. And what we're doing is that we basically, because the mesh is abstracted network, we're actually recording every request that's coming to your cluster, right? Going through all those microservices. Now, in the end of the request, if everything going well, we're not even saving it, we're just toasting it. It's never left the container. But if there is a problem, we're saving it, the header and the body, and we're basically letting you replay the production code. Now, think about it. The way the service mesh is working is that when someone is going to actually make a call to database, it's going through this sidecar. So we're recording even the response and the request for the database, for the S3, for everything, for the storage, for everything that's happening, which means that then the only thing we're doing is spinning this environment in your local environment or your stadium, and then we're just attaching a debugger that we have called Squash, who is distributed debugger that you can attach. It's really cool. I will show you that one. And then basically we're just injecting. So yeah. Now basically you can reply every production card on your record.
It's kind of like a little bit like the sort of event sourcing model where you have the replayability to.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. But you can debug it, and you know, if you think about it, is people really care about all the logs? Maybe for it, but in the end of the day, do I really care about the good ones? No. And that's giving you a problem because then it's a big, big data problem. You have a lot of logs, so you need to sample them, and it's a mess.
Depends if your good logs are actually good or not.
Exactly. So for us, for us, it's great. So I mean, really excited about this announcement today. I think that will be big time. I mean, we have a lot of open source projects. We're getting tons of respect from the community, from the big companies. We're partnering with Google. We're partnering with Microsoft. We're partnering with Ashi, Boyan, with Reddit, with AWS. They'll partner with us, so it's like, couldn't be better.
You had a lot of mentions in there of things just working and stuff, which we know in reality is not necessarily always going to be the case.
Right.
So I feel like an important question here would be, how configurable is everything there? Like, you say there's a lot of kind of stuff that happens for you, but how much of that can you control and change?
Yes. So we're very savvy engineers. So what we're making sure is that everything will be configurable, everything is pluggable, everything is interface. So for instance, just take an example for Loop. In the end of the day, the big question in Loop is, what is a bad request? How do you know when something is bad? So that's configurable, and this is a language that we're creating, and the user itself should tell me what is wrong, right? Like, I mean, if the request is, you know, whatever, we got 500 and it's coming from this user. I mean, Lyft actually using it is totally is a different use case. They actually wanted to make sure that if someone calling them and said, oh, my Lyft is not here, they will be able to, in the support system, click and record everything that related to this specific user. So that's that. In terms of the service mesh, so we're actually pretty good at that. So this layer that we talked about, it is a little bit more opinionated because we want to do the common functionality. There is a lot of edge cases that most of the people don't using, and it's overcomplicated stuff. But what we did, we specifically only superglue. It's not the SMI piece. What we're doing, we're basically drifting it. So we're basically saying, look, this is the basic configuration. But if you actually want, like, we're going to give that. But if you actually want to do something that is edge case in Istio, for instance, go do it in Istio, and we're not going to override it. We're basically going to merge it with our change and serve it to Istio. So I think that basically we're giving you ability to do everything eventually, just in an easier way. So this is basically what we're calling a service mesh app. This is the one. It's built on top of Istio. Of Superglue. What you can see, it's pretty simple. You're coming, you don't have mesh, but you can just click Istio, write the name of the Istio, your namespace, where do you want to install, you're clicking. This is actually not added, so it will take a second until we actually install it. Not too much, though. And what you can see in a second, so you can add now a new one, and you will see in a second, this is pending, sorry about that, I should have added it. This is just not the edited version. And what you can see, this is the extension that I was talking about it. So you basically just is a marketplace, right? And now what you can see, you see it's already almost discovered. You see the services going up?
Mm-hmm.
So it's discovering all the services in the mesh. Now it's becoming green, which means that it's healthy. It's already installed. Now we can go and basically install an extension. It's like the Android, whatever, every other mesh. Right? You basically choose one. This is Flagger. It's coming from WeWork.
Yep, yep.
You're basically just coming, installing it. Start extension. In a second, you will see that. It's
you could all do this with config files if you wanted as well.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Or a CLI.
Easier. Yeah, and you see this overwrite.
Yeah.
Is that if we want to overwrite the simple configuration, we created the layers there. So now you see it's almost green. When it will be green, it will be good. And now you can do exactly the same thing with every mesh that you want to do it. You see how simple it is. It's just like really, really simple. Let me see in a second. It's work. Just waiting for it to get green. Here you go. It's green, right? Mm-hmm. So it's already installed. So we have Estio with Flagger. A few seconds or so, right? The user doesn't need to edit the YAML because there is a YAML kind of thing.
Yep.
And now you can go and do exactly with Estio. So this is kind of like number one. And I'm sure the same thing that they can do right now.
Yep.
It's basically the same thing. And you can install something else and you have the mesh. So that's number one. And I can continue showing you that. The other thing is that I can show you a quick demo of Squash if you want, which is pretty cool. You want to see something cool? Okay.
No.
I really like this demo. This demo that basically people say, shit, this is huge. We're just waiting for this to terminate. It's all in AWS East, so it's a little bit slower.
And then we're on conference Wi-Fi.
Yeah. But I think it should work. Pretty sure it should work in a second. If not, that will help it work. Oh, yeah, it is. See? If not, that will help. Don't worry. I can be aggressive about making it work. But if we're still waiting for the function, and then we'll be all ready. If it's about to work, I will just kill it. Can I show you something between? So basically, I'm just going to show you quick kind of like... Yeah, so in the end of the day, this is kind of like what's the super glue version, right?
Yeah.
Basically, you have all those meshes. We're going to put the layer on top of it. And then we can just plug in stuff. This is like some of the stuff that we know. Oh, come on, buddy, wake up. I think it's almost there. Yeah, now it's loading it. So now it's just starting. Now in a second, you'll see it's starting. It's just I'm giving you a little bit to make sure that everything is killed before I'm actually... Okay, now it's starting, you see? No, I didn't.
Oops.
Yeah, I got cancer. Great. Okay. So in a second now, we're just waiting for the browser to start and we're all set. Okay, so it's pretty simple demo, okay? And it's not related to service mesh. It's actually operate for every tool for developer. Okay, so look at this. This is a very simple application. It's a calculator. I can do a number, it doesn't really matter which. And I can keep going calculator. It's not working. See?
No.
I don't know. So what usually developers do? I will tell you what they're doing. They're not debugging, they're troubleshooting. Because you can't debug anymore. You don't have debugger. This everything is thread. So we thought we can do better. So here's what we did. This microservice is built for two. This application built from two microservices. This is the first one. And basically, this is a Go microservice. Very simple. It basically serves the HTML. And once it's actually getting the two parameter, it's sending it to this Java microservice that I just collapsed. Yeah. Java microservice that getting an either add or subtract and return the result here. Now this is Java and it's in IntelliJ.
Yep.
And this is Go and this one is in Visual Studio Code.
Yep.
Just to show that we can. So here's what we did. We basically created an extension. You can write squash and you're getting command. Squash debug container. So now, immediately, it's going and showing you all the services that you can see in your cluster, all the pod that you can see in your cluster, that you can see. You have the permission. So we'll go with example service one, because this is service one. So now they said, look, in this pod, you have one container, do you want to debug it? The answer is yes. And then we said, which debugger do you want to attach to it? Now, this is Go. Let's go with DLV. And that's it, basically, to attach the debugger. Now, we will do exactly the same thing here. Okay, I'm going to go squash, here we go, debug container. Now we choose the second one, the service mesh two. Then service two, Java, and Java debugger. So attach the Go debugger here, the Java debugger here. It's all running on AWS in East. And now the only thing that I need to do, let's debug it again. Boom. Here's the 99, 22. I can actually step into. Now, when I'm doing next, what will happen? I'm going to jump to the Java. Right? It's pretty cool. And now you can actually go and you can see all this parameter that we have here. Make it bigger. So this is 99. It's good. Let's continue. Okay, so what we can see is that all the parameters is good. Oops, equal 91, that's 22, that's true. But here's what I did. I introduced a bug here. I said, if it's true, I want you to do minus. But this is a debugger, so let's just change it in runtime to false and see if it will fix the problem. So I'm doing this. I'm doing next. What will happen? So we'll jump back to here. Right? And then what I will do next? Let's fix the problem. Now I know that this is how to do it. We're debugging all of my all application that we're building with this. But this is probably one of the easiest, like we build it for ourselves, and then that's why we open source it. It's open source, and this is like.
And you built all the tooling for the IDEs as well.
Everything. Yeah.
That works. I mean,
you can go just to You can go to squash.so.io. Here's the Z. You can see everything that we support. It's all open source. You can go to the GitHub repo.
Oh.
It's like it's all open source. It's all ready to go. You can see there's everything here. People watching. People starring. There's quite a lot of excitement about that. You can also like we have a Slack channel. So you can see in our Slack channels that. Slow. Yeah. Oh, the network here is not great, huh?
Well, that still works.
Yeah.
So
see, that's good. Yeah. This is Squash, you see. So, like, there's a huge community asking questions, asking, and we're helping them.
Wow.
People are actually using that a lot. And as I said, with Loop, we're actually doing it even cooler because we're actually taking a production one and then we're spinning it up locally with Squash. So we have that. I show you the marketplace, which I think it's cooler. So Loop is going to be one extension that you can actually click and download.
Okay.
And that's it. It's going to work. You don't need to do anything. Now you can. You see the overwrite. You can if you want. Because what we created and what we're coming with right now, it's pretty cool now. There was a lot of problems to solve in service mesh that people overlook. For instance, today when I put service mesh, right? I'm starting the configuration from zero. That's where people actually have the trouble. What we did is we basically layered this configuration. So now what we can do, we can actually, which I feel really cool, what we're doing is we basically layer that and then letting you to do what Docker is doing, basically start from 80%. So we're basically sharing configuration. The community can share configuration. And now you can say, I want this configuration. And now 80% is already configured. Now I just need to tweak it the way I want it. So that's make people so easy. So imagine in my app, in the app spot that we have, the service mesh app. So this is like the online version, but I show you it's a recorded demo. So you can see here I have three meshes, right? And you see I have, you know, a few version of stuff extension here and so on. And what's special about that is that you can click here, install mesh, or discover mesh. Then you can do an extension. Then you will be able to say, I want this configuration. And boom, it's working. Three click, right? So that's pretty awesome in my opinion. So that's what we're working on. We're going to make these things so usable and easy. And we are like, look, we're partnering with all these companies. We're going to have a big announcement with Docker, with Google, big announcement with Microsoft today in the keynote. We're working with all those groups. So it's going to be really, I'm very excited about what's going on. Yeah, and we build internally, like, I mean, in the company itself. I'm an engineer in my heart.
Yep.
This is what I'm doing, as you can see.
Yeah.
So I'm very careful about the technology. It's not about making money here. It's really, I want to push this ecosystem. And so we are build a lot of tools internally, and we're working so efficient. Like, it's unbelievable. You look at our code. It's so solid. It's like, so our purpose is just helping.
We say so yourself.
No, you can look. It's open source. That's the beauty of it. Like,
I don't know Go that well.
But people can see, you know.
Yeah.
It's like... I think that the respect that we're getting, one of the things, for instance, like Glue itself. So, you know, like Knative, do you know what it is?
Yeah.
So when Knative got out, it was depends in Kubernetes, in Istio.
Yeah.
And the community put a pushback because it was like, well, you know, it's really a big machine for no good reason using a very simple thing. So they basically reached out to us and said, look, guys, we chose you. We want an alternative for Istio if someone wanted to run simple stuff. And right now, if you're going, you know, just to Knative docs, let's go together. Knative doc online. Oops. And then you're doing documents. What you can see is that if you go in the installation, the option is either Knative or Glue. So Google evaluated our code and decided to go with us. So this is, you know, this is like a good, I believe that's make it good, if you know what I mean.
No,
I mean,
awesome.
So it's pretty good. I think that's going to be good for us.
Yeah, so Shiv Ramjan, I'm the SVP of products at DigitalOcean, and my focus area is really building out the product strategy for the company and then obviously leading all of the execution. Ultimately, with the goal of making sure that the products we build for our customers or developers are products that hold the essence of what has made DigitalOcean special and unique. And so things like simplicity of the product and the pricing and the packaging, continue to build and maintain a healthy community via the products and content that we put out. And then also tied to providing, to the degree that we can, free support for most of our customers. And then, you know, because we're at KubeCon, you know, sort of building on open source technologies, but also making open source technologies consumable. So that's sort of my my focus area. And I've been with the company a little over 2 years now. So took over from one of the founders who was a chief product officer. And sort of have been leading the product and technology vision forward.
Just we'll go back one step just to clarify some things from what you said there. Is DigitalOcean's relationship with Kubernetes, do you allow people to deploy Kubernetes, or are you built on Kubernetes, or a bit of both? I wasn't 100% sure there.
Yeah, that's a good question. So it's actually both. We adopted Kubernetes pretty early on. So we've been running Kubernetes in production internally for about four years now. So our internal control plane that manages our entire cloud infrastructure is built on Kubernetes. So we've been using Kubernetes and related technologies like Prometheus, Grafana, gRPC, internally for a very long time. And so that's great. It has allowed us to scale massively into a global cloud provider. And then now, as of today, we put our managed Kubernetes product out into GA. So this is where we take all the management of, you know, operating the cluster and maintaining the cluster. And then we give that, we basically sell that managed service to our customers. So we do both, but we started being an internal customer first, and now we're bringing all the expertise and knowledge to our customers.
I've got to go back another step now. So you mentioned the infamous simplicity of DigitalOcean, and this was where a lot of people encountered you in the past. I know that's where I encountered you, basically installing and deploying an application. In the days I used to use DigitalOcean a lot, I actually used to do a lot with Drupal, LAMP stacks, that kind of thing. And that was always why I would like using DigitalOcean, because some configuration and one click, and you pretty much had something, and then it was quite easy to get rid of it, and et cetera, when you were just experimenting. Kubernetes is pretty different beast. So how did you combine that simplicity you're known for with something that's pretty complicated and usually being used for fairly complicated use cases as well?
Yeah, so I'll answer the Kubernetes question, but just let me maybe take a step back and give you we were known as the droplet, $5 droplet company, really, if you think about it, right? If you go back, most people who will come to say, yeah, I am aware of the $5 droplet. So what we did was we created a developer experience around launching, building, virtual servers, fun, easy, and exciting. And the reason why we did that was we kept the product generally, from a usability perspective, very easy to use and simple, right? But not without losing the power and configurability, right? So we didn't lose that. And the other part of the mix was getting the pricing and packaging right. And so when you are a hobbyist developer or a student developer or somebody who's just wants to have a blog or try something out, the last thing you need is variable pricing like you would get at AWS, right? Where you don't know if you're going to pay $8 this month or $14. So we started on a very simple idea, which is let's give this experience with predictable pricing. So nice round numbers in $5, $10, $15, so on and so forth. And that has been great. Still a big part of our core business. But in the last 2 years, we've built out a lot of other features. And the idea being that we want to be a place where an application developer or a business or a startup can host their entire stack. So a lot of our customers would say, you know, can we have different droplet types? We want managed databases, so we introduce managed databases. We would like object storage, different storage options in block. So over the last years, you know, progressively we've been adding those additional capabilities. But in every single one of those, what's core is, you know, these four things, which is the product has to be simple and easy to use. Make sure the pricing and packaging has predictability and can scale as you grow. We build a lot of content with a lot of these new products also, and again, embracing open source. So everything that we put out, you know, is basically a nice usability layer on top of open source. Now, if you extend that to Kubernetes, very, very similar. The experience we've delivered today is focused on there are two personas here, right? Which is a cluster operator and an application developer. Our experience today addresses a cluster operator, but even there, we've tried to make the experience very simple. So you log in, you get to your create page, you can go ahead and select your cluster type or nodes, and you hit create, and we give you the kubeconfig, and you're off, you know, with having your cluster up and running. And so, so we've made it really, really easy for very, very specific use cases. Now, when you think about the application developer persona, you know, if they were to use our product right now, they would not find it easy to use, simply because that's sort of something we're going to address later on our roadmap, is to make it easy for an application developer to use Kubernetes also. And so again, we've applied the same formula for the most part to the Kubernetes experience. And so far, we've gotten reviews, you know, unprompted, obviously. I think just a few months back, Kelsey Hightower was reviewing every managed Kubernetes service. And his
Docker a few years ago.
Oh, you did for Docker, yeah. So, and, you know, his comments were, you know, this is a very simple, easy experience and gets you up and running within minutes with your main Kubernetes cluster needs. Now, Kubernetes is complicated, and there is a more complexity as you grow in scale. And so, you know, in the future, we have to address this application developer persona. And then we're also leveraging our marketplace of one-click apps, which we've extended. We now have up to 60 one-click apps since the launch in March. You know, in about a month or two, we're going to introduce a beta where post-cluster creation, you can add additional capabilities. So it could be observability, it could be service meshes. So we're also trying to solve that problem to make it super, super easy for a developer to get going. And so building very specific guided experiences as opposed to, well, here's your create page and you can do 1,000 things. We're trying to guide developers on that journey.
I guess kind of like a droplet of droplets almost.
To a certain degree, you know, the way we think about it is if we can make the experience easy at first, you can go to our tutorials. So you can do it yourself via the tutorials. And then over time, we really automate everything we taught you or guided you in our tutorials. So that's our approach, is we'll put out a lot of learning content and do-it-yourself, very specific instructional content, and so that you can get going. But then when you know, over time, we will also automate a lot of those experiences, so you don't have to figure this out. And today, by the way, if you want to have your own Kubernetes service on our compute or droplets, you can. And we have customers who will do it themselves. So you're not sort of forced to use our managed Kubernetes service. But chances are, if you are going to use managed Kubernetes, you might as well get the managed service.
So actually touching on something you just said there, another thing that DigitalOcean is fairly famous for is the tutorial content as well. Often second to Stack Overflow, you'll find DigitalOcean resources, especially for specific subjects, not for everything, of course. But when it comes to a new technology to you, like Kubernetes, for example, I mean, how do you go about building out to make sure that when people are looking, they find your blog, and then that hopefully leads to customers? I mean, I understand how it works. I guess the second question to that is, when you entered that kind of digital marketing, technical marketing space many years ago, you were one of the first to do it. Now there's a lot of people doing it. So how have you managed to maintain that when you come out with a new technology, you still rank high when people are looking?
Yeah, I think, to answer the question of sort of how do you keep up with being relevant with content, I think there are two things. One, we rarely focus on quantity. We really focus on quality. So there are a few things about documentation or tutorials is that if they're stale, nobody's going to use them. So, we only have a library of 2,300 tutorials. It's not thousands and thousands of tutorials. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It feels that way, right? But it's a small set, and we maniacally focus on keeping them current, right? And because anytime you do a search result, you land on a tutorial, and if it doesn't solve the need for the developer, that's a bad experience. They will never come back. So we can never lose that trust. So we keep the library small, keep it fresh, and then anytime we're launching new technologies, there's a good chance we have some content. So for instance, before launching our Kubernetes service, we actually had quite a few articles around microservices, Kubernetes, CI/CD, and those were good seeds we had planted early on. And so before launch, obviously, we wanted to add more. So we've now built out a whole learning center. If you go to our Kubernetes page, the product page, there's a whole learning center that gives you a whole host of guides based on the scale and stage that you are. And we're also making investments in the whole tutorial experience itself. So making sure there are learning paths in the experience built, making sure we can build in, the level of expertise or experience. And then recently we launched a Q&A portion of the community site where, the community is helping themselves. So people will post questions, community folks will answer them, or we will answer them depending on who has the most current information. And so that has been a really positive way to continue to nurture the engagement of the community in the R&D tutorials we publish. And that continues to feed, obviously, our ranking in search engine, for search engines. So it's been easy because we have this foundation. It's been easy to add to it, but we're not resting. I mean, we have a lot of work to do in the tutorial experience, and as you know, learning Kubernetes is just very complex, and I think there are some additional opportunities for us to bring either interactive learning to the mix too.
I'd like to ask one more question in this area, just because I do technical writing, so you've always been one of these sites that's been interesting. But I know, like, whilst it's obviously, skeptically speaking, it's also a good source of potential customers as well as being a useful resource. Not everybody who comes and reads a tutorial is going to go and sign up and be a customer. In fact, probably a fairly small percentage. So how do you sort of make sure you're not sinking too much time and effort into it, and that it doesn't become too much of a distraction, and you become a content platform too much. That it obviously helps you get customers, but you don't want it to. It's not your core business. How do you keep that balance maintained?
I'm gonna be very controversial and very different here, which is this is our core business, and the core business is the reason why developers love us is because there is a part of the equation where we're giving. And what are we giving? We're giving the best tutorials you can find on the web around open source. So yes, we may benefit from that. You are right. Like, there's a lot of people who use our tutorials aren't building on DigitalOcean. They may be building on AWS. And actually, they will tweet that, very common in social channels, and say, I'm building for my business on AWS, but I actually go read DigitalOcean articles. So part of building a developer brand or a brand that's loved by developers, you have to be authentic, you have to be transparent. And we're very transparent that we are building tutorials around the core of what we have is around open source technologies. And you can consume that on your own Linux box at home. You can certainly do it on DigitalOcean. And why not on any other cloud platform? Like that we tend to be, we are agnostic from, you know, we try to maintain this healthy balance where we're not forcing the reader to say, well, great, now that you read this, now go fire up the Kubernetes cluster and go do it there. Now, we may, in the sense of like, hey, do you want to try this out? Do you know you can do this on DigitalOcean? I think that's helpful. And I think this is a big part of the developer mindset, is that we want to provide things that are helping them, not hey, you know, sign up for an account and selling. And if we have helped them in their journey of learning, launching, or leveling up, they will naturally come to us to use. And we also have to earn this by delivering a product experience, obviously. And I think the combination of that is pretty good. So if we could invest more, and we do, put more community articles and content out, we will. We will continue doing that. That's part of the DNA, and we think it's important to keep doing that. And so yeah, if we, you know, more investments are good in that area.
A very diplomatic answer. So we're obviously here at KubeCon. We've spoken a little bit about the offering. I think you said it was pretty new. So is that what you're here to promote, or is there something in addition to what you had before that you're here to promote?
Yeah, I think the core of what we're promoting today is the managed Kubernetes service. So we were limited availability in December at the last KubeCon in Seattle. And then today it's generally available with some additional features and in available in all of the regions that we operate in. And then the other part that, you know, it's not necessarily part of today's announcement, but we're also, you know, I mentioned this concept of a tighter integration of our marketplace with managed Kubernetes. So we're working with a lot of partners here, meeting with a lot of partners at KubeCon to essentially bring their products and services into the clusters that customers are building. So that will most likely go into beta in the next few months. And, you know, we have a lot of partners here who are excited to be part of the marketplace experience because, you get to we have 500,000 active accounts on our platform. And you know, it's not enterprises. So it's this audience that's not served today with a lot of companies and focus here. And so I think it's a really nice partnership experience that benefits both somebody who's a vendor or an open source project that's building something new and putting it out to you know, individual developers, SMBs, and startups. So that will be we're going to beta soon, and we hope to make additional announcements once that's further along.
So actually, something that... Like to me, as I said, when I first encountered DigitalOcean, you were kind of the go-to place for someone wanting to do a LAMP stack or a I can't even remember what half of them were anymore because it's such a long time ago. Because, you know, you offered that simplicity with a proper server that people could use. But now we're fast forward a few years and you have a limited engineering and support team, of course. When do you decide, if you do, that an application that you used to support is now not really worth supporting anymore and is worth sort of switching off and retiring?
Yeah, so there are a couple of trends that we look at. So in general, you know, if you look at big technology trends, especially in this space, is that usually it takes roughly about 6 to 7 years for some sort of seismic shift to happen. So let's take the shift from VMs to containers. We've been talking about containers for a very long time, if you think about it, right? But it was either last year or the year before when, you know, Kubernetes became the de facto orchestration standard, and now there is a whole ecosystem around it. And so we're constantly watching those types of trends. And, we're about to enter another shift with serverless, right, frameworks that are coming up and functions. So that's something we obviously are monitoring. But But usually a lot of these technologies have a lot of hype initially. So we try to ride out the hype period and introduce them when we think they and, you know, we are fairly open with the developer community. So if there is something that is getting traction, they will tweet us. They'll post on our ideas board. And that's sort of how we may accelerate some of these technologies. So that's generally, and then we also look at Netcraft data, which, you know, if it's funny, everybody talks about, you know, these newer stacks like Jamstack and serverless and functions. But if you look at LAMP and mean stacks in terms of public posts, and they are still pretty huge. They're not.
The internet still runs on WordPress.
Yeah, you know, it's still, you know, so these numbers are huge. And so, you know, I'm sure there are technologies that will be sunset, but again, it really depends. As far as I know, like, if you're a startup founder or entrepreneur who's trying to build a business, you don't start with, like, I'm building a new business and I need Kubernetes. Said no founder ever, unless you're building developer tools, right? So most of the time, it's like, I have an idea, I have a small team, I'm trying to get my application out quickly. And most of the times, they will start with a monolithic application because it's the easiest, cheapest way to get it done. Really, that's really it. And you have a lot of developers who you can find for LAMP, mean stacks today. And then as they grow and scale, then, of course, they will adopt and change their architecture. So for us, it's a balance because you don't want to alienate somebody who has a single-page monolithic app. Who will be fine with the basic building blocks that we have. And we also need to cater to a developer who's learning new technologies or a newer technology company who wants to scale fast, and Kubernetes is the perfect solution for them. So that's sort of how we make these decisions.
Well, what's mean? I can't even remember.
mean is, so it's Angular, Node, Mongo, and I think so. Mean is skipping me.
Anyway
that's how important it is.
So what's as much as you want to reveal, what's on the roadmap for the next 6 months?
Yeah, so we think, let's start with Kubernetes because that's sort of the focus of what we're talking about today. So we are building additional features such as, you know, having a private container registry, better integrations with third parties via the marketplace, and some additional features that make it easy for you to do major or minor upgrades on your cluster. And then we will also start introducing an experience that's focused on application developers. So moving from cluster operator to application developer. So the general idea being that all we want a developer to do is take their code, whether it's on their laptop, in a local environment, or in a Git repo, and deploy it as fast as possible. And we think we can do it within 4 or 5 steps without anybody actually having to understand or deploy a Kubernetes cluster. So that's sort of our long-term vision, and we'll start deploying some of that shortly. We're also adding new database engines. So we recently launched managed databases just about a week and a half ago with Postgres support. We have plans to add MySQL, which is a popular engine, and we will be adding Redis. And so we have a few open source database engines that are on the roadmap that we will deliver this year. And then we also have lots of requests for GPUs, so yeah. GPU droplets, especially, you know, AI, ML-focused companies are requesting that. So that's something that we're thinking in a 6 to 12-month horizon to add to the platform. And then we'll add, you know, platform as a service, like more managed service features to make it easy for developers to really focus on their applications and less so about configuring their infrastructure. So things like static site support deployment would be, especially for a front-end, you know, a lot of front-end use cases, you really don't need an entire server. You can just get it. So that's also in focus over 6 to 12 month horizon.
And I think the final question, a little bit of a silly one to end on, when the founders chose the name, did they realize Kubernetes would become so popular and you had instant naval water themes without even planning?
Yeah, actually, it is kind of funny. I don't think the founders ever thought this would happen, but the story about the name is obviously it was named after one of the famous paintings in Tokyo, which is a wave of Kanagawa, which is a famous painting. And so they were fans of that, and they said, let's come up with a name that incorporates this. And that's how DigitalOcean was born. And then obviously we were lucky. We have a mascot in Sammy and, you know, everything with Helm and Kubernetes just fits perfectly. So, yeah, you know, this is just coincidence, but it's a good one because we like it and it fits really well with the with the conference.
My name is Matthew Whittington. I work at Atlassian on the Kubernetes team. So my team is responsible for running a whole bunch of Kubernetes clusters that run internal and some external workloads for Atlassian. So the main workloads we've run are to do with builds at the moment. We run all of our internal CI/CD pipelines, the things that build Confluence and Jira and all of our products on top of Kubernetes. And we also run Bitbucket pipelines builds for external customers on our Kubernetes clusters.
I guess that was going to be my first question, is it's not something you offer to people explicitly, but you do partially through the Bitbucket pipelines then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we're not in running sort of a managed Kubernetes solution or anything. We're not trying to be a public pass or something like that. Atlassian's still all about selling, Jira, Confluence. Those are our main products. And yeah, I guess that's all I have to say about that.
No, I'm not in the business of a pass.
I was wondering. It didn't seem that obvious. I mean, you have Bitbucket, but and there are some code hosting providers who do have kind of pipeline tooling of some description. But yeah, fair enough. Atlassian's been around for a little while. I'm guessing you haven't always used Kubernetes. So when did you switch and why? And how fraught was the effort?
All right. Okay, so that's an interesting question. I guess I'll go back in time a little bit and talk about our original cloud offering. So originally we had a platform called On Demand, Atlassian On Demand, and that ran Confluence and Jira, and I think Bamboo at one point, in the cloud for people. This was sort of 5 or 6 years ago. This was the sort of main way you could get our products on the cloud. And then we've since, at that point, we were running on-prem. So we had a whole bunch of racks in a bunch of data centers in the US, East and West Coast. And on those, we were, like, I was on the team that managed those, like the infrastructure that we used to host all of those. And we were doing that ourselves, hand-rolled. Kubernetes didn't exist at this point. So I started on the team, for reference, I started 4 years ago as a grad. So this platform was already well built before I arrived and it was running pretty well. When I jumped in, we were managing a lot of these servers. We were more and more people wanted these cloud offerings, so we were sort of having to go out and do data center trips more and more frequently to build out more capacity. And so at one point, the company as a whole decided to move to AWS. And so there was a big shift to try and get off running these containers on the on-prem stuff and push it up to AWS, but that required a lot of re-architecting. So that was sort of step one in what ended up getting us onto Kubernetes. Not quite related, but somewhat related. Then, after we'd lifted and shifted our products that were running on demand onto AWS, we then moved on to, we had a few different teams around Atlassian that were working on Kubernetes just for their own workloads, because it had sort of, I think it was 1.1, 1.2 version at the time. And then one of our architects came out and he said, well, if we've got three different teams around the company working on Kubernetes, why don't we try and spin up one team, keep the knowledge localized, have better knowledge, better iteration, and sort of have a building block of infrastructure that people can leverage. So they spun up this team for about 6 months, and it was pretty successful. And then after that, I joined the team. And the first workloads we wanted to put on were build engineering workloads, because that, like, it seemed like a low-hanging fruit. It was not going to affect any external customers negatively or anything if we failed. And we succeeded pretty well.
I'd forgotten about Bamboo, actually. I always forget that's a tool you have as well, or still have, I guess.
I'm not really sure what the situation is.
Well, that would be the next question, is do you use Bamboo as part of this workflow, or
yeah.
just...
Okay. Yeah. So our internally, we use Bamboo for our builds, and we also have the option now to use Bitbucket pipelines for our internal builds. So that's been around for a while, but we're making it a lot more first class at the moment internally. But yeah, we're using... So everything was running on Bamboo, and we managed to get all the Bamboo workloads from running where they were onto our new Kube solution, and sort of it's been really good. It's given us a lot of cost savings, and the experience is pretty good.
Sometimes I've forgotten what I've actually written. I also remember I wrote about Bitbucket pipelines about 2 years ago as well. So sometimes it's jogging my memory too. I mean, traditionally, as far as I can glean from the applications and documentation, you've been mostly a Java application house, but more recently a lot of other languages too. So are you still kind of mostly supporting a lot of monoliths, or have you been switching out to a lot of microservices along the way as the kind of, I guess, the user demand on your applications has changed as well, and that, I guess, Kubernetes has possibly facilitated that change as well?
Yeah, so we're definitely still primarily a Java shop. All of the products, the big ones, are written in Java. We definitely have a lot more Java developers than developers of any other primary language. But we have moved to microservices. So with that lift and shift from on-prem, where we were just running monoliths inside containers, one container per customer. Okay. So that's why we needed so much capacity, because we've got these big JVMs in containers sort of spreading them out. We moved from that to the cloud, and in doing that, we'd started decomposing into microservices. And right now, we're very much a microservice shop. We have a lot of different microservices making different parts of the experience, and they all sort of work together to get the final page rendered, sort of thing.
You mentioned there one container per customer, which I guess seems like a logical way to divide things, but yeah, it does seem like a lot of workloads. Is that something you still do, or for certain customers, or no?
So that was the entire design of our old system. So we had a system, the old on-demand system, running on our on-prem stuff. We called it Unicorn. I think we've got a patent out for the exact design, because it was sort of weird and cool at the time. And it was basically, we were using OpenVZ containers, and we ran one JVM per customer with the products for that customer in it. And so what we got out of that was we could actually just lift and shift the entire container with a little bit of tooling that we'd written, and sort of move it around between instances, restart the products, and we could sort of manage exactly where things were living. So it was a very manageable system. It just wasn't very scalable because of the amount of resources it required, especially when you consider that not everyone is using their product all the time, and yet we have all this stuff just running there.
Okay. I'm guessing that... as much as you want to divulge, a lot of these changes have probably made you more infrastructure efficient than in the past, and probably saving some costs there as well.
Absolutely. That was a big driver for us to move everything into AWS, because we definitely got cost savings, and we're using our resources a lot better, and sort of it enabled us to start tackling some other initiatives down the line that we probably couldn't have. We were basically at the end of the road with the old design.
Atlassian is also one of these sort of strange companies where your enterprise, a lot of enterprise heavy users who tend to be somewhat conservative with releases and things like that, but you're web first. You know, in theory, you can roll out updates whenever you like, but your customers probably don't want that a lot of the time, or there are business reasons to not do that as well. So how do you manage those release cycles in that you now have this infrastructure that you can update regularly, but you probably have a lot of customers who don't necessarily want everything updated all the time as well?
I can't answer that question fully because I'm not in the teams that do the rollouts, but what I can say is that when you're on cloud, you're locked into the latest version, basically. Okay. So you are going to get those updates, but we do everything that we can on our side to make sure that we're not going to screw the customer.
I think it's probably changed a little, and I seem to remember it used to be more like big releases every now and then. But yeah.
Well, I mean, like part of the journey to getting onto the microservice thing was that we had to be able to update fast. So towards the end of on-prem, we had these really cool cycles of rolling releases where we would roll out across the globe so that we'd hit people in the time zones that they probably weren't using their instances.
You mentioned on-prem there. I'm guessing you probably still have quite a few users who do want on-premise installations.
Yeah. Yes.
And how do you support that with Kubernetes, if at all?
Okay. Yeah. Interesting question. So we obviously make data center versions of our products, and we provide support to people who are running those. As of yet, we don't have a Kubernetes solution for that, but I believe it's something we may end up looking into.
And it seems to be something that a lot of people here are speaking about, having to support enterprise clients who usually in those cases have legacy applications they want part of their cloud, or for data sovereignty reasons they want something in a very, very particular place.
Yes. With a lot of customers who have specific requirements about things, and those are the ones who are usually running data center. Yeah. I mean, from our point of view, having people on cloud is best for us, but if there's reasons that they can't do that, then obviously we want to accommodate that.
Interestingly, on that vein, you mentioned a minute ago, and I think this was an old item, that you only had data centers in the US, but is that still the case? Or
we don't really have, like, we still have a couple of points of presence, but we don't really run any data center.
But with your AWS presence, you can have European and stuff.
That was another big reason that we switched, right? Because if we want to spin up in another region, we can just ask for it from the cloud provider.
And I suppose, where are you in this rollout process right now? Is it still in the middle? Is it finished? Switching to Kubernetes.
Oh, to Kubernetes, right. So, glad you asked. So, regarding Kubernetes, so we've got all of the builds on there basically at the moment. And that's pretty solid. It's been working well for a while. I've been on the Kubernetes team now for about two years. And Kubernetes at Atlassian was about 2.5. As I said, there was that 6-month spin-up period. And in that time, we've made sort of the Bitbucket pipelines experience really good for the team there. So they're able to develop with a lot more velocity now that they don't have to worry about any sysadmin stuff by taking the management of the infra away from them. We've got our builds working really well. And so we're turning our sites to running services as the next step. So what we're going to do is get our microservices eventually running on Kube. So we're going to get the compute running on Kube. And hopefully get some kind of service mesh set up in that to make give a real big incentive for our developers to transition over.
What are you at KubeCon to learn, to promote, to network? What are you at KubeCon for?
Definitely at KubeCon to learn. That's probably primary reason number one. The space for Kubernetes moves so fast that we really need to keep up with it. And a lot of the time, KubeCons are just great for meeting people from other companies who are having similar problems, who solve things in interesting ways. We can share the ways that we've solved problems. So, for example, we made a piece of software called Escalator that runs on top of Kubernetes. And that was because we found that when we were migrating our build-end workloads, we had problems with the original cluster autoscaler. Because the original cluster autoscaler, it works based on pending pods in the system. So if I schedule, say, 5 pods, 3 of them get homed and 2 of them are pending, the cluster autoscaler will see that there's not room for those 2 pods and add another node. But that's too slow if people want their builds to start immediately. And so to fix that, we had a bit of a talk with the cluster autoscaler people, but the problem turned out to be quite a bit more difficult, in-depth, and philosophical towards the actual overall design of cluster autoscaler than they wanted to accommodate in that project. So we went off and we built a thing called Escalator, and that's been working really well for us. So we open-sourced that. I think AWS has linked to that in the docs for EKS now, if you want to do batch workloads. So it's really quite mature now. And what Escalator does is it will leave Slack capacity in the system. You can configure exactly how much with a bunch of different knobs and config. And so it has that much Slack capacity to absorb sort of mini spikes in your job workflow. If there's a big spike, it will still obviously take a little bit of time to scale up. But the cool part about Escalator is it will scale down fairly aggressively depending on how you tune that Slack space. So you can save a lot of money if you have a workload that's going to spike, because cluster autoscaler is fairly conservative with removing nodes because it's sort of meant for a service-based workload where you kind of have a static ish amount of services running in the cluster. So yeah, with Escalator, you'll scale down really fast and be able to save that money if you're just getting a large spike in batch jobs.
That's actually going to be my next question. as through this experience, what have you contributed back to the community? That's one thing. Anything else?
There's a few things in the works that we'd like to contribute. So we open sourced a tool that we made very early on called Cube Token, and that was a way to authenticate to clusters. That was before a whole bunch of other people came along and did, you know, OAuth integrations and, you know, Spiffy and all that sort of stuff. So that was sort of early on. It's not particularly relevant right now, but we have a whole bunch of things that we would like to open source, a whole bunch of tools. So for example, internally, we have a thing called Cyclops, and that is the cycle operator for nodes. So we wrote an operator, which you could give it a custom resource definition, and it will take that, know about a node group, and know, you can tell it, you know, I want to cycle this node group with this concurrency, and whether you want to preserve the jobs on there, if they're jobs that can't be interrupted or not, and it'll just go off and cycle those. And that's really important for us because we run a lot of different clusters running a lot of different nodes, and if a CVE comes out that we need to patch really quickly, then, you know, that's the simplest way for us to just cycle it. So stuff like that we have internally, and we would love to be able to open source that. So we're working towards sort of being more free on the open sourcing.
Yeah. Is there or have there been any particular topics or talks at the KubeCon so far that have been very relevant or of interest to you and the team?
I've kind of got my ear out for a lot of service mesh stuff at the moment because that's every day there's a lot of sessions on service mesh, so I'm just attending a whole bunch of those unless there's something else that interests me a bit more in that particular slot. That's important for us because we're moving towards offering service mesh, because, you know, as I said earlier, we're running a lot of different microservices now, and so if we can get the power of mesh to all of those microservice developers, we're going to get a lot of big wins because we'll get a lot of extra metrics, so we'll be able to see, you know, the whole state of the system a lot better. We'll get some routing rules. It'll just be a lot better experience for our developers. So definitely interested in the service mesh side of things. Multi-cluster, still rather interesting for me because, like I said, we run a lot of clusters. We've got over 10, I think, the individual Cube clusters that we're managing. So we have a bunch of tooling around being able to build and deploy to those together. But anything about multi-cluster, still very interesting because it could simplify or change the way we do things.
You've mentioned so far a lot of the advantages it brings to the internal developers. I guess some of these may seem fairly obvious, but what have been some of the advantages to end users, as far as you know as well? And have there been any disadvantages or problems to changing the way you run things?
Right, so we haven't got many services running on top of Kubernetes yet. Okay. Yeah. So when we lift and shifted and moved to AWS, what happened was we have an old pass that's been around a little bit longer than Kubernetes called Micros. And so when we moved from the monoliths to the microservices, we moved everything into this V1 pass. So the V1 pass runs on raw AWS instances. It's a hand-rolled management system for AWS resources. So it'll set up your instance replicas, which are each running on an individual EC2 instance, and then there's an ELB fronting all of that. What the goal is next, now that we've got all the builds running on top of Kubernetes, is to get some of those services migrated across, because the old pass, you know, you're dealing with EC2 instances and VMs, the spin-up time, it's a lot longer than it is in Kube. So we can get, you know, an order of magnitude better spin-up time on top of Kube. So that's one reason that we, like developers internally, would want to move on top of Kube.
And I guess in the... So you don't have production builds on Kubernetes yet. It's mostly for developers.
Except for Bucket Pipeline.
For testing.
Yeah. None of the microservices that serve Confluence or Jira.
And this is mostly, I guess, just it's... You don't want to take the risk right now, or it's just a lot of work, or
thing. One of our Atlassian values is, am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
Yeah.
So one of the Atlassian values is don't fuck the customer, and that's a big thing that we take on board here. Like if Kubernetes is a sort of emerging technology, we have to think a bit enterprisey here and not make sure that we're not going to screw them over.
Yeah, it's actually interesting. I have interviewed a few enterprises here, and they're still it's weird because Kubernetes feels like it's been around forever and everyone's using it, but it's only 5 years old. And to a lot of people, that's still too immature.
it's quite old now.
So I think Two final questions. One more specifically to this, which would be, what's next on your plans with Kubernetes?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so one thing we're really working towards and excited about at the moment is Kata containers. Are you familiar with Kata containers? Yeah, so for us, because we run Bitbucket pipelines, security is a huge deal for us, right? Because we're running a whole bunch of customer workloads. They can supply whatever code they want in their Docker files and YAML files that describe the build. So we're basically running completely untrusted code for a whole bunch of customers. And we want to make sure that all those customers' data is as secure as possible. We want to make sure that our clusters are as secure as possible. So adding an extra layer of isolation there with Kata is something that we're really excited about. We've been working on getting that going. Kata's still sort of early days, but we've been working pretty closely with the Kata project, raising issues, submitting a couple of pull requests, or working with the Kata guys on some pull requests. So hopefully we'll get that working at some point in the near future.
So I guess my final question, which is a little tangential. One of the times I've been here, I was fortunate to be invited to the Atlassian Dev Camp or whatever it's called a couple of years ago, and also speaking to you, Atlassian engineers always seem to be very, very, very good at explaining things very clearly. Actually, it's fairly well trained in explaining things very, very clearly and very professionally. Well, the ones I've met, anyway. Maybe I've just been very lucky. it's quite likely. But ignoring that, is there a particular kind of internal? And also, I mean, like a lot of people seem to stay there quite some time. So, is there an internal culture to encourage engineers to sort of step up and be more than just good developers and actually kind of be more knowledgeable at what they do and good at explaining it and understanding, you know, why things are useful and et cetera? Or have I just been lucky?
Okay, so internally, we have a very big blogging culture. So, we run a Confluence instance for our intranet, basically. And we are encouraged to blog our findings or interesting things that we come across. We have a real culture. We have a thing internally called boot camps, where if someone sees a gap in the knowledge and wants to train people, they can set up a boot camp session and people can sign up for that. So there's a lot of incentive and initiatives to share knowledge between Atlassians. So that might contribute to why you find things easy to explain, easily explained.
Yeah, who knows?
Yeah, so, and regarding people staying there a long time, the company, the values are good. The culture is really nice. They provide nice office spaces for us. The founders have direct sort of lines of communication down through the company. Basically, the company's a nice place to work for, so people stay. And the engineering force is also very, very talented and clever.
And that was my interviews with Idit Levine, Shiv Ramji and Matthew Whittington. I hope you enjoyed. Next week I'll be back to normal schedule with some links and an interview. I'm not 100% sure what interview that will be yet. I still have a little bit of a backlog to sift through and figure out which will fit nicely. And in the meantime, you can find previous episodes and show notes at christianchiller.com/podcasts, accompanying newsletters at christianchiller.com/newsletters. My events calendar is now coming to an end, so I have nowhere for you to tell you where you can meet me over the next few weeks. I'm hopefully going to be in OSCON in July. I also need to book everything, so that might be the deciding factor, but I hope to be. So any US listeners. And you can also get in touch with me at Chris Chinch on Twitter, or contact details on the website I've already mentioned twice before. First episodes of the Enthusiastic Amateur should be coming out soon. I'm just editing the second episode and about to record the third episode, and then I will start releasing. And a few other bits of creative writing should be coming out soon too. So until the next time, if you have been, thank you very much for listening.